The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
I encourage you to move on with your dessert while we are doing the presentation. We're going to begin with the recognition of the Woods family. And we have tonight Deacon and Mrs. Knight representing the Woods family. We are so delighted to have you here. Please stand. Please give out the signs of love. On page 3 of your program, you will see that we have an impressive group of students graduating in the class of 2009. And so a few of them are here this evening, so people can please congratulate them on their completing graduation. Also, we had a survey and collected some information about the class of 2009, 10, 11, and they've done some really outstanding things, and so we wanted to share that with you. So we have a moment this evening or later on next week. Take a chance and see, and I'm sure you'll be so proud of it as we are. We have sort of our tradition for the Woods Conference is our Rising Star Award, and we absolutely have a star here this year. And we have a former Rising Star presenting it. So it's really my pleasure to ask Tanya Jones to the podium to present this year's award. She moved to Reston, Virginia in 1991. She is a graduate of the Virginia Commonwealth University. She has a Bachelor's of Science in Criminal Justice. During the summer, after her first year here at American, she interned with the Honorable Judge Anna Blackburn Rigsby of the D.C. Court of Appeals. She returned to intern during that fall for Judge Blackburn Rigsby, as well as working here at the General Practice Clinic. In the summer of 2008, she worked for Skadden Arc as a summer associate, and she will be returning to Skadden Arc after graduation and passing the bar, right? I told her I wouldn't talk about it too long when we met earlier today. She was pretty shy and bashful, really didn't want to tell me much about herself. I said, well, tell me something personal, like what's your favorite color? So she told me green is her favorite color. And someday she aspires to become a professor. So without any further ado, please help me in honoring the 2009 Rising Star recipient.
Nobody is here because we got here alone. People died, people fought, and we really have to give back to each other. And Ms. Weaver, I'm sure, is going to be very happy because I constantly go into her office with some idea, but she was always there, always, always, always there, and I thank you so, so much. Judge Lee, whose email address I have, I'm sure, to the recipient of the Alumni Association. But thank you for encouraging me and for encouraging our entire class. And to the class of 2009, thank all of you for being there with me. Edgar, who was Balsa president last year, Roslyn, Lameen, Kiki, and Aga, who was the president when we were 1Ls. Thank all of you, thank the upcoming 1Ls. To the 2Ls, the 1Ls are gonna need you next year. The rising 3Ls, you know, your job is not over after you've given what you have to give to the 1Ls. And to the rising 2Ls, the 1Ls are really gonna need you. So we're all in this together, and I really thank you so much. And I'm a little nervous because I have my moot court competition tomorrow. So thank you very much.
I think you'll agree that they made a really good decision on choosing your remarks, although not prepared for them. Congratulations again. Our next presenter, I'm not even sure, needs an introduction. He is here every year supporting this conference, but I think we need to give him a reserved parking spot because he's here so much. He's a member of our Dean's Advisory Council, but he always responds positively when we ask him to do anything for the community, graduate students, professors. And so it's my pleasure to introduce Judge Lee. Now I'm having a problem saying his name. Judge Thurlow.
Good evening. It's an honor to be here at the Woods Conference and to have the Woods family involved. And we want you to know that we value your participation because Judge Woods meant so much to us. And we stand on his broad shoulders. Tonight, I have the honor of presenting the Joseph Hairston Award to one of my classmates from WCL. And before I do that, let me say that I intend to present it this way. First, let me say a little about Mr. Harrison. Then, Judge Walton, who is another classmate of ours who was not present, has sent a note which I've been asked to share with you. And then I'll introduce Judge Jones to allow him to accept the award. Mr. Joseph Harrison is one of our pillars. If you ever been to the Supreme Court, notice there are four big columns that enter the Supreme Court. Well, Mr. Harrison is one of those pillars. He is a person who has taken a stand, who's been very sturdy and upright, and who has reached back as he moved forward, which is part of the tradition of this law school. Mr. Harrison graduated from this law school in 1960 and became a tax lawyer and was one of the first African Americans hired by the Internal Revenue Service. Excelled in his work in the Office of Chief Counsel, and at the time he was hired, he was the second African American to be hired, and rose through the ranks through the mentorship of others in senior management who saw promise in this lawyer with military experience and military background, many others. And he later became the senior executive and a director of operations division of the Chief Counsel of IRS. To tell you about this position, he handled all of the administrative responsibilities for 2,000 lawyers, the budget, and responsible for the hiring. And by the time he left, decided to retire from IRS, their ranks had increased to almost 13% in terms of lawyers of color who were representing the ranks of the IRS. And some of that was because of the efforts and the excellence of Mr. Joseph Harrison. Another role that he shared that to me has always stood out is if you've ever been to a National Bar Association meeting, and if you haven't been to one, I encourage each of you to attend a National Bar Association meeting at least once. And I think once you go once, you want to go back again, because you'll meet lawyers from all over the country. And this organization, which was started in the 20s by a small group of lawyers, continues to exist today, has about 80,000 members. And Mr. Harrison was a treasurer, the only person who served as treasurer for about 25 years in the National Bar Association. If you go to the National Bar Association, you'll see Mr. Harrison and the respect he receives from everyone. So the award that we've established here is to honor an alum who has had exceptional professional accomplishment, a record of service and integrity in our community, and we want to acknowledge his accomplishments. The person that we selected for this year's award is Honorable C. Darnell Jones II, who is a United States District Judge in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia. As I mentioned, Judge Jones and Judge Reggie Walton were classmates, Judge Jones is a class of 1975, Judge Walton class of 74, and Will Truitt class of 1976. Here's Judge Walton's remarks. Dear Darnell, I can think of no one else who is more deserving of the award being presented to you. Having had the opportunity to know you both personally and professionally for over 35 years, I can say without reservation that you epitomize what good citizenship entails and what should be expected from members of the legal profession. At the time you joined the Defender Association of Philadelphia in 1975, I knew you would become a superstar of the profession. Your Midwestern work ethic, your commitment to excellence, and your profound sense of right and wrong are qualities I knew predestined you for stardom. As a public defender, you rose through the ranks of the Defender Association of Philadelphia to become one of the office's leaders due to outstanding representation you provided to many individuals who lacked financial means to retain legal representation. And you left your mark on that office that few, if any, was ever equal. Your rise to the Court of Common Pleas bench in Philadelphia was historical, as you pierced the veil of political patronage that had sometimes awarded a judgeship based on factors other than merit. So too was your campaign for a seat on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, an effort that would have been successful but for the political machinery throwing its support to other candidates, even though the Pennsylvania Bar Association rated you as the most qualified candidate for the position. Again, you challenged the old boy network, and although you did not prevail, I believe you have set the stage for further debate about how judges in this country should be selected for positions on the bench. It is therefore fitting that reason, rather than politics, prevailed when vacancies on the Federal District Court of Philadelphia had to be filled, and a Republican president chose you, a Democrat, to fill one of those positions. I wish I could be with you to celebrate your receipt of the Harrison Alumni Award. However, even though I am not here in body, my thoughts, respect, and love are with you in spirit. I'm honored not only to have you as a colleague on the federal bench, but more importantly, to have you as one of my best friends, Judge Walton. I want to spend a few minutes introducing Judge Jones in a way that's going to embarrass him because he's a very humble person. But I think it's important for the law students and the future law students to know about the accomplishments of Judge Jones and to know what we hope the future holds for you. Because I'm confident in this room, there are additional federal judges and attorney generals, and dare I say it, chief executives of major corporations and ambassadors and deans of law schools. And president? You know what he said, Well, let me say of Judge Jones that excellence does not just happen. It's a decision you have to make every day. Excellence does not just happen. It's a decision you have to make every day. I recall meeting Judge Darnell Jones when I was a law student, and he was a second-year student. And as a first-year student, we looked for role models. And Darnell, as we called him then, presented himself as someone who had a seriousness about the way he carried himself. He did not speak very often in slang or colloquialisms. He talked in complete sentences. He carried his books. You saw Darnell, he had books. You saw him a lot in the library. He'd have his books spread out. He had a very rich vocabulary. He was very adept at handling all human relationships, and he had friends from all walks of life in our law school class. And you could tell he was purposeful and forthright, honest and selfless. And that was how he presented himself when he was in his law school. Now let me tell you a little about his background as a judge. Judge Jones was recently sworn in to the United States District Court of Eastern District of Pennsylvania in October 2008. He previously served as president judge of the Court of Common Pleas in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia from December 2005 until his appointment to the federal bench in October 2008. Now, president judge presides over all the judges in the Court of Common Pleas in Philadelphia. He was appointed chair of the Administrative Governing Board of the First Judicial District by the Supreme Court shortly after his election as president judge. Prior to that, Judge Jones served in the Court of Common Pleas, and he handled business cases. He was also presiding judge at various times of the Adult Probation and Parole Department. He presided over the Homicide Division, the Major Civil Trial Division, and his last assignment prior to becoming President Judge was in the Commerce Case Management Section, where he handled complex business matters. As you've heard, prior to becoming the judge, he was in the Public Defender's Office, and he served as Chief of the Family Division, and he also worked for Citizens Crime Commission. In Pennsylvania, he is a member of the University of Pennsylvania American Inn Court, and he serves on the Advisory Board of New Directions for Women, Salvation Army Board, and the Board of Visitors for Drexel University Law School. He has worked with a number of texts that we use in law schools, including Moore's Federal Practice, Criminal Defense Techniques by Matthew Bender, and he has worked as a law professor at a number of law schools and is very actively engaged in continuing legal and judicial education. He instructs in the areas of trial advocacy, court administration, jury selection, evidence, capital cases, and juvenile law. He's previously served as a law professor on the adjunct faculty at St. John's University, Temple University, and where I know Judge Jones has helped many people, many judges, is at the National Institute of Trial Advocacy. He's currently an adjunct professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, and he served on that faculty since 1993. He and I are alumnus of the National Judicial College, and he joined the faculty in 1998, and he told me today he just resigned from the faculty at the National Judicial College, which is the national university that judges from state, judges from all over the country go to for 2 or 3 training courses. And he has taught classes at the National Institute of Trial Advocacy and National Judicial College on handling capital cases, capital case initiative, and criminal evidence. He's received numerous awards, and I won't read them all. He has served our nation very well, and recently, before he left Pennsylvania, he established a program that you may have seen on the national news, and that involved a program to help homeowners in distress. And the idea was that before a foreclosure could occur in the city of Philadelphia, that the mortgage holder, the mortgage company, and a judge would meet and try to see if there was a way to mediate to allow those homeowners in distress to maintain their homes. I think about how important that is in this day and age. Judge Jones is married to Evelyn Jones, and the couple had 5 children and 5 grandchildren. Judge Jones, to whom much is given, much is expected, and we thank you and would like to present you with the Hairston Award.
Thank you very much, Judge Lee. Good evening to all of you, Dean Grossman, Shauna, Mr. Hairston. Thank you, sir. Thank you so much for allowing us to stand on your shoulders and your history. To the Knight family, it's been an honor to meet you on behalf of the Woods family and on behalf of all of the law students here. I just want to make a couple of points, if you will allow me a little bit of time. Let me do 3 things. The first thing is to recall back when Judge Lee and Judge Walton and I used to sit outside and commiserate about what we could do one of these days if we ever became a lawyer. I have to tell you that I don't think any of the 3 of us ever dreamed that we would be federal judges. But by the same token, I don't know of any law school, and I've taught at quite a few, and I've had an opportunity to visit even more, and I'll be going to SMU next week to be on the panel there. Dean Grossman, what I see in this room is absolutely incredible, and is a total honor to you, because this makeup is unlike any other makeup of any other law school in the United States. It's incredible. Folks, when I came here in 1975 as a first-year law student, I remember so well looking at my checkbook the week before classes started and saw that I had $85 to my name. I went to Sears Roebuck out in Chevy Chase and got a job putting labeled oranges for income my freshman year of law school. Today, I'm glad to say that I have a check for $1,000 to give to the dean for the benefit of minority scholarships. And there will be more coming, I can promise you that. Folks, Judge Lee alluded to what I was able to accomplish in many respects, but none of it was without the help of other people, including the boss of students at this law school and the upper class persons at this law school. The mortgage foreclosure program is incredibly important to me. It's important to the people who live, who need to have a home. It was also important to me as a judge to put my robe aside the week of Hurricane Katrina and get six friends of mine, and we obtained two trucks and filled them up and went to Slidell, Louisiana, just across Lake Pontchartrain from New Orleans, and spent a week there helping people clean out houses and trying to salvage as much as we could. For me, the greatest opinions I've ever issued were two. One was the opinion that I should go to New Orleans, and the other was the opinion that I should do something for people who were becoming homeless, many of whom were there in those positions through no fault of their own. I challenge each and every one of you, yes, go out and make the big bucks because you will, but do something for your fellow men and women, for it is, in the end, what lasts, and it is, by all means, the most rewarding thing you will ever do. God bless you all. Thank you so much.
Walton in writing. I would like to say that we're proud to count all three of the judges among our alumni who have made significant contributions to legal profession and the strengthening of the rule of law. In my own practical activity with in international law, I've seen time and again that when we want to limit the arbitrary use of power by the state or solve disputes among individuals, at the end, when everything ends, the difference between the civilized society and other societies is that we can go to a judge. And the judge will determine what happens and what doesn't happen. And take away the spirit of individual revenge, the solving the issue by myself. So it's the secret of this country, and that should not be a secret kept in the corridors of school, but should be announced in open windows, is precisely the existence of an independent and powerful judiciary where people can go and find justice. So we're proud of our judges who carry that important message, not only internally but externally. And we see ways to be able to be proud everywhere. And we see whether our judges have the time also to spread that message in countries where that is also very new. Well, along a similar line in the sense of recognizing the work of judges, I'd like to briefly share with you the impression I had when I met for the first time Judge Vanya Woods. Because I'd like to say, again, you know, things have an ability, an exquisite ability to claim credit for all the good things and claim someone for the bad thing. But, you know, the idea of this conference was not mine, it was Cherry Weaver's. And Cherry is a good person. Inspires other people, put them online, goes after them until the conference takes place. I will take you that. Of course, I'm glad to continue to take the credit, but the credit what we can do is to support her. And I met Judge Sylvania Woods for the first time. I remember that he told me that he had failed the bar like three times. You know what he did the bar? And I had more touch. You know, again, we know professors sometimes measure through grades skills that are required for certain things. For example, to be a law professor. In accordance with the process of cellular reproduction. You know, you measure people. You know, that's why diversity is so important in the composition of appointment committee. Because people find excellent suspicion on people that look like them. Mm-hmm. You know, without the pluralistic composition, you know, of the student body or selection committee, very surprising, the standards of excellence will be determined in accordance with the people who are deciding them. Mm-hmm. And it's not that they do it, you know, rationally perhaps, but these are very studied the processes that take place in the subliminal fashion. And then the judge, as a role model, was telling people how many times he has failed the bar. And we taught them then, and I thought that we would continue to think that of course it's important to take a look at commercial banking, but the image and the role model that Judge Sylvania Woods presented was more important than the numbers named game that has also an ideological composition. And in my conversation with Judge Sylvania Woods, it was short and so forth, but he was a very impressive person. The presentation was something unbelievable. I detected these tremendous values of opportunity, and resilience, and perseverance. So we are proud that he graduated from our school, and we're proud that this event really has become a tradition. Because I would say in Washington, everything that happens more than once is a tradition. This is a real one. You know, it's a tradition with capital T. It's a tradition from 1997. And I would say I only repent of one thing, that the judge Woods would not be here. I would have loved to hear his comment concerning the election of President Obama. Because that is something, I just came from the Dominican Republic, for example, where I was with the student and another person from the school arguing against it. And the enthusiasm that exists around the world, that people know that the economic difficulties, the tremendous issues of peace and security cannot be solved by an individual alone, and all these types of things take time. But the message of hope and possibility that the election of President Obama is predicted to the world is remarkable. And as remarkable as that is the way in which President Obama has conducted himself. You know, in international relations, an area where I have to work, the appointment of people, and again, talking about multitasking, because we have the tremendous issues of the economy in the country. He had to multitask in have a midnight. His presence really has inspired people into opportunity and possibility. And I think that that is very, very important also, that we understand that this is not a task for one individual, and that the commitment and support that is required for the values that this president represents are very important. It's a part of politics. It's something that has to do with important right work. In that spirit, is that we celebrate this conference and we celebrate the North Star Award every year, which is given in recognition and appreciation of the professional achievement and outstanding contribution by an African American to our law school and of the community at large. I will also say this, it's not so easy to get inside recognition. I mean, there is a famous expression that nobody is a prophet in his own land. And then I would like to say that this year's recipient, our own Professor Perry Wallace, certainly is someone that deserves this award, and more than deserves, because the lexicon doesn't give justice to this. The fact that internally he has been selected shows even more how much he deserves this award, because it's very difficult to be a prophet in the world. Now, some of the tremendous achievements I have highlighted with all these achievements, I was going to show the documentary for
the screen.
Okay. And I would say the documentary is a very powerful, testimony of what our esteemed colleague represents. I think we should reproduce it and send it to you. But particularly when I had in my presentation, I wanted people to really well receive struggle for equality and his own presence in places that did not allow the presence of people like Perry Wallace. But some things that are not in the documentary, and without telling here any big secrets, that are very important for the purpose of knowing the personality of Perry. Perry rose from Moore's beginning with the support of his family. He was the youngest of six children and grew up on a farm in rural Tennessee. Although his parents never went to high school, they had a great respect for the importance of education. Perry attended national segregated public primary and middle school and made straight A's in high school, where he graduated valedictorian. I will tell you also, I came to this country for the first time in 65 with the Fellowship of Experimental and International Living. And we went to Nashville. And for us, it was unbelievable, the group at that time of 12. Young law students from Latin America to see segregation, that people could not go to places because of the color of the skin. And we had serious debates because the fellowship included meeting with people from the State Department also. And I will spare the details of those debates, but it would be enough to say that that led at that time the United States not to ratify some international treaties because there were issues of segregation in the country. So I witnessed with my own eyes what it meant. That not that Latin America, there was no discrimination, but there was not the jure discrimination at that moment. Well, very, but I could see the situation that existed in that moment. We were, we went through different parts of the country, the Greyhound buses, for example. And we had these Lakotas in the houses of families, and we had discussions with them because of the issues of racial discrimination. But in that environment, our esteemed colleague graduated valedictorian. As an all-American high school athlete, Perry was recruited by several Southeastern Conference schools, including Kentucky, Tennessee, and Vanderbilt. He chose Vanderbilt because of his strong academic, and because basketball coach Roy Skinner was someone who was very described, quote, would look you in the eye and talk straight, end quote. Well, as you almost all of you know, Professor Wallace became the first black player in SEC basketball in the late 60s when Vanderbilt University reflected elite Southern society. The values his mother and family instilled in him at a young age and that he developed, such as honesty, integrity, perseverance, hard work, and grace, helped him endure the difficult period because he was subject to discrimination, humiliation, threats, and racial slurs. The dignity and demeanor that Terry displayed to all of it, wanting the respect and admiration of men, so much so that in his senior year of college, Terry was voted the quote most popular student. This is not, again, when there is discrimination, in order to achieve a certain status, people have to be better than that. And they have their measure by standards that go beyond what the others expect of everyone else. So this fact, again, is something unbelievable that our colleague achieved. After graduating from Vanderbilt with a bachelor's degree in engineering and playing professional basketball for 1 year with the Philadelphia 76ers, Terry decided to pursue other goals. Following a year with the National Urban League, where he worked with Ron Brown, the future U.S. Secretary of Commerce, and Vernon Jordan, Terry entered Columbia Law School, where he was awarded the Charles Evan Hughes Fellowship, and subsequently embarked on a successful legal career where he once again broke barriers. Integral to Perry's professional evolution was, and still is, his commitment to civil rights. While still at Columbia Law School, Perry worked on capital punishment cases with Jack Greenberg and the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. He also worked at the recruitment and training program with Ernie Green of the Little Rock Nine and Bayard Raskin Organization's founder. Perry's work continued through his work as legislative analyst to Mayor Walter Washington, the first African-American elected mayor of D.C., and with the Minority Business Enterprise Legal Defense and Education Fund, where he served as special counsel. Later, Perry moved into legal education at a time when there were very few African-American law professors. That value of education, of integrity, of example, that he developed even further, once again led him down a path less followed, and here too Perry excelled. Well, it is a tremendous understatement to say how grateful our community is that Perry ultimately showed that path, joining our school in 1991 as a visiting professor, and then the following year as a full-time professor. Perry's areas of specialization include business, environmental law, corporate law, finance, and international arbitration. Professor Wallace is currently also the director of our joint JD MBA program, and is spearheading our efforts to create a center on commercial arbitration in the hospital, who I hope, if there will be more faculty members here, I will say we hope to approve it next Monday in the school. But knowing Perry and with our more support, I'm sure we will not take no for an answer. Professor Wallace is one of those rare individuals with universally liked and respected by students, by the faculty, by the staff, by the alumni, for his knowledge and commitment to our institution, his pioneering spirit, and his extraordinary strength and courage in the face of adversity. Perry is someone who always tries to bring out the best in others. Of course, in an institution like ours, with almost 1,500 students, and 70 full-time faculty members and 250 adjuncts. We have tension and discussions. This is not the Soviet Union, or it's not McCarthyism. This is a pluralistic institution with people that want to exercise autonomy. And the strategic way to conduct a lawsuit is with the possibility to have disagreements, talk about it and solve it. And I have seen many courts is personally how Professor Wallace has always played the role with the tremendous dignity and civility of someone that brings the best in us. And from that point of view, enough, I would carry a card that would say, I support Professor very well. Let me say, without further delay, I want to extend our warmest congratulations on behalf of this institution. We're proud and honored to have you as a member of our community.
Thank you so very much. This is a very special award, and it comes at a special time and in a special place. The special place is the Washington College of Law, where I've been for many, many more years than I worked at any other place and have been in any other place. That says a lot to me, but it's for specific reasons. How many places step forward and say, we stand for justice, we stand for equality, we're not ashamed. Let's just put it out there. This is what we do. Now, and this is also a special time, and that's obviously so. The occurrence of having the first African-American president in the United States obviously has few parallels in the history of the racial the struggle for racial equality and for justice in the United States. So place and time get to be important. Let me say a word about this North Star. You know, it's a concept and not just a star, Polaris, the one star that doesn't change its place and therefore slaves could find a guiding light to freedom. Well, the concept is still apt, and don't think that we have only a historical concept. Why? Well, I'll ask you the question. Does America still need some guidance in addressing issues of race? Have we moved to that post-racial society? Well, I think you can imagine what I I think, and with all great appreciation of the progress, the wonderful progress in this country, and the very special place that this country occupies at its best in the world of the fight against discrimination, against hatred, against injustice, against inhumanity, that we still have a way to go. And I think most sensible people will accept that. And whenever you have a ways to go, you need a guide. We all need a guide, and we all need a North Star. So I guess the title of my little talk is The North Star Then and Now. We know about the North Star then and its value, but what about the North Star now? And the concept is one that we still need. And I think I want to show you a number of North Stars tonight. Don't look around, because it's you. It's you, and it's me, and it's all of us. All of us who have the charge and should energetically, enthusiastically take on the charge of fighting for freedom, for equality, for justice. I hope that we can learn the lessons of the old people and of the new people, all the ones who were the wise ones and smart ones, and not forget about those as we integrate into all of our activities, all of our important endeavors, this sense of justice, this sense of freedom, this sense of the essence of the human spirit at its best, which fights for freedom, which does not give it up unless it's beat out. And what you have to know is just not to let it happen. Now, the North Star inspired a lot of people who didn't run away from slavery, who stayed down south, and my family was one of those families, and there were just many, many others. It was the concept, it was the spirit of the North Star that inspired us all and that carried us all along the way. Here are just a few things that I want to try to do myself over the next several years. I hope I have more than a few years, and several years, but I want to share those because these are things that are important to me, and I hope that I can convince you to share in them as part of what we hope we can do here in America. For America, for American society, it is my fervent hope that we can take the energy, that we can take the opening that we've had presented to us with the Obama campaign and continue the dialogue on race in America. This is such a difficult thing for America to do. I went to law school with Eric Holder and known Eric Holder for a number of years. I tend to use a little more temperate language, but if you know what I mean. But I still share the same point, that this is a difficult dialogue. It is not easy. It's going to take people with just the kind of portfolio of skills and abilities that we're talking about here, not just intellectual skill and wonderful professional training, but a sense of the essential nature of the outcome. And that has to do with the quality of human life, not just in the sense of equality, but moving on up to those higher levels of accomplishments as human beings in a society and in a world that has engaged with these highest principles in the world. I hope that dialogue can continue. And you know, you North Stars have got to lead the way. You've got to provide a beacon. It's got to be bright. It's got to be strong. It's got to be true. This is what we need from you North Stars as we move along. America has often had difficulties in addressing this topic, and with good reason if one knows the difficult past. But it's possible, and the energy of this most recent opening with the Obama campaign, I hope we can take it and run with it. There are just a couple of other areas that I think are exceedingly important, and for us as professionals, as people who are accomplished and well-trained, we can do such a magnificent job. One is mentoring and role modeling. Mentoring and role modeling. Now, we've become professionals, and I was listening to Dr. Skip Gates just the other day, and he was talking about how we're not living down the street from poor black people anymore. We live, and it's just fine. It's an unintended consequence of success. We're not there nearby so that little black children, young black people, can see all of these African Americans who are doing so well, who are not in trouble, who are not, I mean, it was wonderful to see the Obama family and to see the world appreciate the Obama family. But, you know, one other part of it was, hey, you know, it's almost as though they don't really know that there are other black people who are doing fine, who are not on the edge, you know, who are not off on drugs, who are doing fine, and who love and cherish their family. Love and cherish their history, love and cherish their culture, and who have, and seeing that. Now, you know, it's wonderful, the Black Magic movie is just great. One of the themes in that, when you look at those historically black colleges and universities, and they also show you some of the communities, you look around and you see what people like us saw and what I saw in growing up. I could just walk down the street and run into successful black people. I had decent folks. I had uneducated black people who would come and say, I act right, you got to act right. Where you going? What you doing? And it better be good, and it better make sense, because otherwise, you know the old story. I'm gonna punish you, and I'm gonna take you home. And then we're all going to punish you. And you're going to act better. So what do we have in the face of developments that have taken us away from everyday intercourse with the majority of the black community who need us, who really need us, making the effort. Judge Jones' effort was heroic, and it's a model unto itself, as he is. And we have to decide to do extra. We have to decide to do extra. One of the things that I've started trying to do is something that I call drive-by mentoring. I know it sounds strange. Drive-by role model. You know what that means? That means that I can't all the time devote a lot of hours out of the week to a program as I used to, and I don't have the energy that I used to have, and time, got family, and all those things that are important. But you know, you'd be surprised how powerful an impact it can make on a young person to spend just a few minutes. And I was reminded of that during the Obama campaign. I was somewhere in Washington and walking, and there was a young brother who was dressed in construction clothes, and I walked up and I spoke to him. And he seemed to be shocked. I was dressed about like this. I spoke to him. He was shocked that a black man with a suit would speak to him. And I said hello, I talked to him, and we talked about the election and various other things. You could see the look on his face. And we talked for about 3 minutes. And he seemed to feel better, but it meant something to him. Drive by. I met and encountered for only a few minutes at a time Martin Luther King, Barbara Jordan, Fannie Lou Hamer. And what an impact that made on me. They spent a few minutes. And when that was done, I would never be the same. That inspiration is exceedingly important. So the mentoring and the role model. A final point that I want to ask that we encourage, and it's the dialogue about who are and what does it take to be, and what skills and attributes are those that go along with being a leader and an advocate. Why do I say that? And a role model. Why do I say that? Because we got a little inconsistency here that we want to work out, and I hope that you all can help us do it. I'll be a little bit more honest with that, about that. Here we have, over the years, I've heard some interesting negative commentary about people like Colin Powell, and I'll take him as an example. I'm not going to ask you to express one view or another, but I think that deciding whether or not people are of value and of worth because of what party they belong to and rejecting them out of hand without actually evaluating and looking at who they are, I think you might run the risk of missing out on important people. You might take people who are leaders and who demonstrate leadership attributes, and you might just throw them away. That's just a type of prejudice. And for us to add that in with some of the other historic prejudices, we prejudice about people's skin color and prejudice about all of this stuff, it's just madness. And when you're still not free, you know, how are you going to decide to pick up some artificial, silly reasons for not liking people? I hope, and one of the things that I'm talking about here, this inconsistency, will take some black people and criticize them so harshly. On the other hand, we'll let other role models or leaders or others just kind of get off easy. And part of what I'm talking about is some of our black athletes. Now, I have nothing against black athletes. some of my best. I love them, I care all about them, but I got to tell you, when you're going to attack a wonderful person because he's a Republican or he's a whatever, and then you're going to let people get away literally? You're going to let them attack, abuse, rape women? You're going to let them walk around harming people, harming themselves? Because that could not be a positive, healthy way to be. I think that we need to impose, and I hope that you North Stars will help us impose levels of accountability, of responsibility. We don't have to demonize them, but I think that if we don't seize control of their race car and decide whether or not it's actually properly played or appropriately played, I think that it's going to continue to be tough. So those were some points that I've been, my wife will smile tonight. She wasn't able to be here because her mother's ill. But she'll smile because she didn't have to listen to me. She ran and raved about this the way I do every night. I appreciate so very much not only the award, but I wanted to share with you I think they're such important points. I think that we've got some energy here. We've got a past that's so rich, so strong, so unknown throughout the world and throughout human history. And that if I can, thank you for letting me do some drive-by. Class of 1976.
Joe Harrison, 1960.
C. Darnell Jones, class of 75.
Mike Spin Knight, class of 1975.
Nabila Issa Obidi, class of 2005.
Maria Greenfeld, class of 85.
Class of 1988. 1982.
Will Harold, a JD class of 1990, I loved it so much. LLM class of 1997.
Good evening, Angela Johnny, class of 2000. Cynthia Jones, whom I bounced ideas in terms of who will be on this panel, as well as Professor Smith. Is she still here? Okay. They were both great. And always a special thanks to the Office of Special Events and Continuing Legal Education. These people work so hard. They have an event or two or three a day for about 5, 6, 7 weeks. So I'd like to ask them to stand so that we can recognize their hard work. Jennifer Dobson, Denise Hussey, Amir Tajani, and Damian Rogers, thank you all. Thank you to the Office of Technology, Brian Rapp, and Russell Confroy in particular. Of course, to Dining Services and to Facilities Management, especially our Monica, who is the person we obey always. And to congratulations to all of our students. If you're leaving us, God bless you, we'll miss you. If you're staying, God bless you, we'll continue to love you. And for our final tradition, I would like to ask Ms. Mamso. Mamso, please come forward. Mamso is going to be editor-in-chief of the American University International Law.